I'm Jordan Marr, and this is Farming in British Columbia, a podcast that, unlike my farm business, can easily accommodate the ankle I just broke right before farming season. My guest today is Brody Bolin. He's 28 years old and a third-generation rancher and butcher based in Jaffrey, in the southeast corner of BC. Brody's grandparents established the ranch in 1957 as a commercial cattle operation. Brody and his wife Cashton now live there and operate a farm-to-table business model in which they're directly involved in every step of producing their beef, including delivering it themselves to households around the southern interior.
The farm that we have, what we call our home quarter, is we're operating on 160 acres on our home quarter, and then we range our cattle on about 22 square kilometers of crown range tenure, as well as we've probably got, I would say, between 500 and maybe 750 acres of private pasture typically that we lease. We run a cow base between me and my family of about 100 to 125 head. I would say that what we do is we're mostly a grass-based business. Our cattle are kicked out with calves, calved on grass, kicked out on crown pasture, as well as some irrigated private pasture that we operate. Then in the fall, they're brought back in, calves are weaned and sorted depending on what we want, either to go into the beef business that we operate or to be sold commercially to Alberta to the feedlots. As well as we also run a group of sheep on our operation on the farm. There's about 35 ewes that are run over the property in a rotational system, as well as you run a bunch of goats for weed management.
It makes sense that Brody was attracted to a farm-to-table model, because by his early 20s, he'd worked in every stage of beef production. He learned to cowboy growing up on the ranch and working for larger ranches to the west and the east. He apprenticed in a butcher shop, and he's worked in multiple abattoirs.
There's only one plant in our area, and that's in Creston, that I haven't worked on the slaughter floor of. Every other one, you know, I've worked in.
If you ever get a chance to have a beer with Brody, I suggest you take it. He's pretty fun to listen to, as you'll soon learn. And that's probably all I need to tell you to set this up. Here's my conversation with Brody Bolin of Bolin Livestock. Brody Bolin, thanks so much for joining me on the Farming in British Columbia podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. I'm really excited to be here.
Brody, before we talk about your operation specifically and what you and your family do, because this is a podcast about farming in British Columbia, I would love for you to first talk about just your part of the province, both generally, geographically, and agriculturally.
Well, you're missing out. It's the best corner of the province. I don't think there's another spot in our province as nice as the one I'm living in, but I'm a little bit biased as far as that goes. So we're in the southeast corner of the province. You know, we're about 45 minutes from the Alberta border on the east, to the Crow's Nest Pass. And then we're 30 minutes to the Roseville border as well. So we're right in the middle of the Rocky Mountains, obviously, in the East Kootenays. Majority of what we run in or what we operate in is timber. Snow comes off, you know, depending on the year. But snow usually comes off, I would say, about either late March, April sometime, and then we get snow again either November, December, depending on the year as well. And then our snowpack, you know, we've got Fernie, which is 50 kilometers from us, which is one of the number one ski towns in British Columbia. So we've got a lot of winter to deal with, a lot of snow to deal with, and we're right in the heart of the mountains. Majority of agriculture in our area is commercial beef. You know, there's not as much as there was of it, but most of them, you know, are guys running somewhere between 100 to 200 head of cows, give or take, and they're commercially shipping out to Alberta to the livestock markets. There's, you know, a few guys who are raising some sheep. There's some hogs being raised. There's not a whole lot of chickens as far as that goes. Not a ton of market gardens, though there is, seems to be more and more kind of popping up agriculturally. Not a lot of fruit trees as well, and there's just about zero grain production. So cows are pretty well where it's at. We are surrounded by crown, and there's a ton of public land around us.
And so if I'm driving through, I'm going to see lots of cattle. Am I going to see much irrigated pasture of any kind, or is it a whole heck of a lot of? Go ahead, sir.
There isn't hardly a producer around that doesn't use irrigation or doesn't have irrigation rights. I don't think I know of one guy in our local area who doesn't have irrigation rights and isn't running on irrigated pasture. It will get hot here in the summertime, and without irrigation, you know, we'd definitely be kind of out of luck. So we'll get 1 to 2 cuts of hay, and that's about all we're getting, depending on what we want to graze. But typically we're getting 2 cuts of hay. you know, there's different guys in different pockets, maybe Grasmere and I guess Creston, which is to the west of us, that are getting three cuts. But other than that, we're getting two cuts of hay and it's all irrigated pasture. There's no dry land.
You're going to be telling us, we're going to be talking about your kind of your own operations, kind of farm to table business model. I'm going to take a guess that when you talk about all the ranchers in that part of the province in general, that's probably less common. I'm going to guess it's a lot more commercially focused, as you call it, operations.
Yeah, a ton more commercially focused operations. Like, you know, if you were to go sit inside of our local, like Waldo Stockbreeders, we call it, which is our local livestock association. If you were to go sit in there at a general meeting, you might find two or three guys in there who are selling beef direct to consumers. And everybody else in that room, you know, is shipping cows or shipping cattle to town. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it's been done for years and years. There is more guys, you know, springing up who are doing 5 head, 10 head here and there, and they're realizing that it's, you know, a very viable option and it's a different way to, you know, run cattle or run livestock and market it that way. And so it is becoming more popular. Another tricky thing is, you know, we don't have as many butcher shops or as many abattoirs as we had. So access to slaughter has been a very difficult thing over the last couple of years. And I think that's what's kind of driven guys away from it a lot more than the viability of it.
And we're going to devote a good part of our conversation to that challenge in a few minutes, but let's just go back in time a little bit. So, with no disrespect to your grandparents, I don't think we'll linger on your grandparents, other than I will say, cause I've read from your website that home quarter section you described to me, it sounds like it was established in the 1950s by your grandparents and they started the ranch. That's right.
Yes, that's correct. You betcha. 1957, they bought that place.
Right. And then your parents took over and you grew up there, and it sounds like they oversaw things during a pretty volatile period of cattle production. You reference your parents doing interesting things to make it all fit together, to make ends meet. So maybe you could tell us about that period of cattle production and maybe tell me what else they were doing to just make it work.
They were selling farm to table meats. We had a milk cow at home and we had a huge garden. So my stepmother is one of the most, I would say one of the most talented gardeners I've ever seen in my life. She touches something and it grows. So growing up, we had a huge garden. She could grow anything. We canned, you know, we dehydrated stuff. I can remember Saturday night sitting around and we'd watch a movie and we'd all have a butter churn we'd pass around, or the ice cream maker. We'd make homemade ice cream. And it was the highlight of me, you know, growing up in the weekends or during the week and going to dad's. And that was something that we did. Dad had a butcher shop, and so he was always big into, you know, trying to market stuff that way and doing some custom stuff, as well as, you know, he raised a lot of pigs. He sold a lot of wiener pigs. We had tons of chickens. And BSE, I remember when BSE hit, and I remember us having a pretty small herd at the time. And I remember, you know, lots of guys were still shipping things and we're still sending a lot of cows down the road and a lot of heifer calves down the road. And dad was basically doing the opposite. He was bucking the system. He was keeping back as many females as breeding heifers as he could. And he was only, you know, taking them. He was breeding them and he was going. And what he said at the time was, he said, I don't know if I can afford it, but he said, it's going to come back at some point. He said, and when it does, I want to be ready and I want a chance to grow a cow herd. And he said, if they're not worth anything to the guys in town, they're worth something to me. Mm-hmm. He said, and so we're going to keep them. And he did that for a long time. And, you know, he really took the time to develop the beef herd that we kind of run today and a lot of the genetics that we have today by doing that.
And that was in the 90s, right?
That was it. That was in the 90s and 2000s. BSE yeah. hit, I want to say it was 2000, just about exactly, is when BSE hit. And I remember him doing that then. Yeah.
So you clearly, though, just in your description from a minute ago, you look back on your childhood and your time on the ranch with fondness. Did you feel that way at the time? And a related question is just like, was there much stress in the household around the economics of the family business?
I mean, there was, but like, if Jordan, if you met my dad, he's the most positive man you'd ever meet. Like, I won't say he doesn't have a bad day, but he's able to take something that's absolutely negative and he can flip it around and find a positive in it. I definitely remember a lot of stress in those times. But you know, at the same time, I remember him just kind of like buckling down and going to work with it. I always tell the joke that I don't remember my dad taking me fishing. I don't remember my dad playing a lot of baseball with me. But, you know, I'm 10 years younger than my sister. I'm 7 years younger than my brother. And, you know, when I was old enough to kind of go along, we did farming stuff. That's all we did. Dad and I rode around in a tractor together. My first memory of chasing cows, I was 4 years old on the back of a pony. And Dad couldn't find a babysitter. And we had to move pastures, and he had a 40-foot lariat rope dallied around his saddle, and I had an ornery pony that did not listen. I remember him telling me, hold on, he goes, and if you fall off, he said, just stand there and holler. And I don't remember it as a bad or a scary memory. I remembered flying over hills with him chasing cows and thinking, this is the greatest thing I've ever done, and I can still remember it. I still remember thinking, I'm a cowboy. This is so cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, everything it seems that we did, like he always brought a lot of fun growing up, but it was always during work. You know, we'd check cows and he'd show me things and he'd teach me things, or, you know, I was old enough to get my hunting license and it wasn't, okay, let's go sit in a deer stand somewhere. It was, hey, let's go for a walk. And sure enough, I think we're hunting and he's checking fence and he's checking grass and he's looking for a bull that we've been missing for, you know, a month. Right. So
yeah.
He was really good growing up about not letting the fact that there was a lot of work, you know, to do, get in the way of the fact that you're a kid growing up and there's still some fun to be had. And that would be one of the number one things I learned from him is no matter what you're doing, if you can just smile about it and have a little bit of fun, anything can be fun, no matter how boring it is.
And do I infer correctly, though, that just from what you said before, that you spent some time living off the farm? Did your mom live off the farm?
I did, yeah, you betcha. So my parents divorced in 2000. Mm-hmm. And so I lived part-time with my mom and Jaffrey. We were 2.5 kilometers away,
yeah.
And the bus drivers were all my aunties. So yeah. Anytime I wanted to get on the bus, I got on the bus. And the school, and I'd get to Dad's, and that was the only rule. If I ever got there and I didn't call my mom, right, I wasn't allowed to go. But as long as I made sure she knew that's where I was, it wasn't a big deal. So I had free rein, and I spent, you know, growing up, it was supposed to be every second weekend. And then by the time I hit 10 or 12, it was, you know, every minute. Like I loved cattle and I loved agriculture as long as I can remember. We did a bit of an interview with Columbia Basin Trust, and they asked me, you know, how long have you wanted to be a farmer for? And I said, for as long as I can remember. I didn't have monster trucks and superheroes and dinosaurs. I had farming stuff. I believed, honestly, like I had the biggest collection of sleaze toys you'd find. And mom had asked me what I wanted to do, and I told her I wanted to be a rancher. And that was from the time I was little. Dad was a brand inspector. He'd take me with him on brand inspections, and we'd go see other people's cattle and other people's places. And yeah, it's just something that I've always loved and I've always wanted.
And as you approached adulthood then, did you imagine taking over or getting involved in the family ranch, or did you have other aspirations for as far as agriculture goes?
Yeah, you know, for a long time there, I stressed really, really hard over the fact I didn't believe that it was possible. I honestly believed the only way that I could make a living as a farmer was if I got a really good paying job and I could do it in my spare time.
Well, can you break that down a little bit?
Is that to say that
by the time you were into your teens, was that not paying the bills for your dad's ranch?
No, and so that's the thing. I should have put that in about our local area. So that's the one thing I'll tell you is majority of the cattle producers you'll find around here, and I am sure it's quite similar in lots of parts of the province and parts of the world, but majority, I don't know of hardly one cattle producer in our area who doesn't have a job off the farm or doesn't have a wife
right.
who works in town.
Right.
And that was always the running joke, right?
Mm-hmm.
Behind every good rancher, there's a wife that works in town.
Yeah.
But Dad always had a job off farm. Everybody did. And I just remember going, well, I got to better find something that's going to pay me good money so that I can be a farmer. But there was nothing that I really loved as much,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I've had, you know, I worked in the local sawmill. I took my first year of millwright training, and I worked for a company working in the coal mines, doing shutdowns and doing millwright work. You know, I worked for some guide outfitters. I did some different stuff. I had a whole bunch of jobs, and there was nothing that was just there that was like, yeah, this is for you. This is what you should do. And it wasn't, I remember working in the sawmill and working night shifts and thinking, holy Hannah, I was sitting there one night and just stay awake because you're sitting there watching boards run by and waiting for buildups. And I remember racing myself and racing the clock to see how many sunflower seeds I could shell in a minute. And I can't tell you what the number was, but I know it was astronomical and I got good at it. And I remember sitting there thinking, if this is what I have to do so that I can farm in the days off, it's not worth it. Yeah. And so I found a job working for Douglas Lake Cattle Company, you know, in the Nicola Valley. And I went to work there as a cowboy. And I said, I'm going cowboying for a bit and I'm going to try it. And I'm going to see if I can, you know, who cares? If I can't make a living out of it, I can make a life out of it. Yeah. And I did that. And then I realized, you know what? There's different ways to do it. And I saw a lot of guys doing farm to table stuff and a lot of guys, you know, doing different stuff. And it was a long ways from home. And we didn't like my wife and I. We'd started dating and we'd been dating about a month and I moved away and I said, you're welcome to come with me if you want to, or you don't have to. And she come with me. And we lived over there and we worked there for about 6 months, I'd say. And I found a job working south of Calgary from a wonderful family. UXL Ranch is what they're called. A man by the name of David Ball and his daughters and his son. And I went to work for them and we calved about 800 head of cows. Well, 600 head of mother cows and 200 head of heifers. And I went, holy smokes, I'm doing what I love. Like, I love this. And I'm getting paid to do this. And I remember coming home from work, just doing an ear to ear to my wife and going, and they had her, you know, hired on hourly, treating calves and helping calve cows and washing equipment. And I thought, this is fantastic. And it was great. But again, it wasn't home. I say it and I mean it. The Kootenays are the prettiest place in the world. And once you've been here, you never want to leave. And we were so wanting to go home. And there was a lot of late night discussions. And I remember talking about farm to table and how other people are making it work. And I said to, you know, she was my fiance at the time, not my wife. And I said to her, I said, Cash, if other people know how to raise cattle and other people know how to, you know, sell cattle and they know the ins and out of it. I said, my dad was a butcher. My dad's been a butcher, you know, my whole life. There's no reason that we can't do this. There's got to be a way that we can figure this out. And so, you know what? We moved home and I started apprenticing at a local shop. And dad said, this, if you want to do it, you got to go get an apprenticeship. You got to learn to do it nose to tail, start to finish. And this is what you got to do. He said, and you got to learn to make sausages and you got to learn to make value added products. He said, because that's what's going to make it work for you. And we did that and we built it from, you know, absolutely nothing. From the little group of cows that I was able to purchase. And, you know, we leased for a while there, you know, we were contracting and the deal was I'd work my hours at the butcher shop and then I was allowed to work a day for myself to cut beef that I was selling to somebody. Mm-hmm. And we started it that way. And then I was contracting slaughter at a slaughter plant up in the Columbia Valley. And I was able to rent the shop for a day. One day a week, I could rent the shop off for the operator. And we'd slaughter cattle on, you know, cattle, pigs, sheep, on Tuesdays, Mondays or Tuesdays. I'd cut on a Wednesday. We'd come back and slaughter on a Friday. I'd pick up my meat. And then my wife and my kids at the time, we'd pick up the meat. And then the weekend was spent, no matter where we were going to, we went and did deliveries.
Yeah.
And the way that we always figured it out was we were getting to hang out as a family. We were getting paid to travel. So that was the Okanagan, the West Kootenays. My father-in-law's in the West Kootenays. So essentially it was a family trip. We just had to throw a couple extra boxes in the back with our suitcases.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how we did it. And that's how we started it. We free delivered. And I went from working for somebody else to completely doing it on our own, working for myself. And selling beef out of somebody else's shop. I mean, I'll put it to you this way, Jordan. We're about 2 hours from that plant in that shop from home. And we went there 5 days a week. We drove back and forth. 250,000 kilometers we put on a pickup truck in a year and a half trying to run and to make it work, right? Hauling cattle to the plant and hauling cattle back and forth on the range. And you know, like I said, when we started that, it wasn't a matter of, oh, this is a really good money-making scheme. You know, we're going to make money at this. The only thing I said was, if I can break even, and like when I was apprenticing at the butcher shop, I was making $19,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the ranch that I was leasing was $18,000 a year worth of rent.
Yeah.
And we sold and we did whatever. And that was me working full-time. And I was driving at the time I was apprenticing, I was driving an hour back and an hour to work in the morning and an hour home 5 days a week. And I said, if I can make enough, I don't care in our first year. if I can make $19,000, if I can just do that on top of it, and I don't have to go to work for somebody else, I'm doing as good as I was before. And so that was our goal. Our goal was the fact that my time wasn't worth nothing because I was doing what I liked. And as long as I was doing what I liked, then my time was free. And I still look at it quite often that way. Most of the time I find myself doing stuff and everybody's like, oh my gosh, how are you still here? Well, you like it. And when you like what you do, there's not a morning you get up that you go, geez, I really don't want to go to work. You know, you get up and go, I got to go to work, but boy, am I glad I get to do the work that I enjoy.
So but I want to ask you, what was the relationship when you got going around 2016? What was the relationship between your new operation and your dad's, like, and has that changed since then? Are they two separate operations, or have you?
They've been two separate operations since day one. We as a family made that decision.
Yeah.
You know, we'd originally looked at it and thought, well, hey, we want to try to buy in. And the problem that we always came to was, number one, we weren't making enough money to buy in. And when you're born on a farm, labor's always free anyways. You can't really count your labor. So, you know, before she passed away, she signed the farm over to myself, my brother, and my dad.
Mm-hmm.
So it is in our three names already. So, you know, my name was on the title. And so we put a house there and we started building something, and that's what we did. What I did get from my parents was, you know, Dad lent me the facilities that I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Dad lent me the knowledge that I needed. Dad lent me the extra hired man that I needed, you know, on days when I was short, and, you know, signed me onto the range tenure, allowed me to pay, you know, my portion of the way so that we could work together and run two operations simultaneously. Quite often they cross over and they're the same thing. But no, they run their own business and we run our own business, but we run it on the same property and on the same range tenure.
Cool. And so we're going to kind of move into slaughter and butchering now as a topic. And I want to just go back briefly to 2016. Was it pretty simple? Did you decide to apprentice as a butcher because you realized that the model you wanted to pursue was kind of farm to table, like farm right down to the end customer? Is that like, I just want to get a sense of why that was crucial for you to go and get that skill.
So I knew for a fact, here's what I knew. Okay. I knew as a person that there was processors and there was producers. And when there's a middleman, no matter who the middleman is, number one, there's more money being spent. Number two, at some point you relinquish control on quality.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. We've always cut our own beef that's been in our freezer from the time I was a little boy. We've always raised our own beef that was in our freezer from the time I was a little boy. We always slaughtered our own beef that was in our freezer. And it was the fact that you knew step by step by step that that product was handled properly.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a producer who, and I'm not knocking it. I'm not knocking it. I understand that not everybody is in it. But to me, one thing it was one way for me to gain trust from people that I didn't know, that I was trying to sell them something and I was trying to prove to them that it was good enough. But the one thing I could guarantee them was this: if they had an issue with the product, no matter what that issue was, they didn't have to call somebody and somebody say, well, I'll have to talk to the producer because I'm not sure. Or I'll have to talk to the processor because maybe something went bad in their cooler. Or maybe something happened. There was one phone number, one set of hands, and one family that was handling a product. And there's nobody else to blame but myself. And right. that was something to me. It was just a little bit of a marketing deal. And I've always been interested in it. Dad had a butcher shop for years. And I wanted that. I wanted to see, you know, something that we raised, not even from the time it was born, but from the time that I kept a heifer back that I thought would match good with this sire because of his EPDs and because of his physical qualities, that we can cross a breeding. And at the end of the day, I can look at that product sitting on my plate in front of me and say, hey, this worked, or hey, this didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And all the way along, I had a chance to look at it.
So, okay, can you talk about barriers or limitations around slaughter and butchery in BC?
So I will tell you that the problems that were had in 2016 and the problems that were had today are probably the same thing. The only benefit I will say different today is small scale meat producers worked very hard to get the Farm Gate and Farm Gate Plus licenses passed. And that was a huge win for the ability to access local food for local, you know, to sell local food for local producers, but to access local food for local consumers. And that is huge. And it is going to make waves in this, in our local industry and in the provincial industry. It is, it's so astronomical. I can't say enough about it. But that, so the issue that we run into lots of the times and other producers run into is that there's only so many processors and there's only so many abattoirs. Mm-hmm. And before this FarmGate Plus license, you know, in our local area, I'll say, so I've got an abattoir that is 100 kilometers, just about, well, not quite 100 kilometers from me that we use. It operates about 8 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. Now, I've got another one 50 kilometers away that is a BC abattoir that operates 12 months out of the year, and another one, another 50K from that, 100 kilometers away, operates 12 months of the year. Two problems. Number one, they're still 100 kilometers away, mm-hmm. and they've got absolutely no bookings. And number two, they'll only process meat that they cut and wrap themselves. So for us, it doesn't help. The next nearest one is the one that I, you know, worked at in 2020, and the one that we cut our beef in, you know, in the start of 2020 and 2019. And that was Columbia Valley. And again, they're booked so far out, you've got to book 4 months in advance. Well, for some producers, and including ourselves, 4 months in advance just isn't enough. You've got a market that's sitting there, and you've got people that want to buy a product, and you can't get that product processed or slaughtered or harvested or however you want to call it. You're sitting there with your hands tied, and you're basically watching your money fly out the window and go somewhere else.
So what you're getting at is just a major bottleneck, a lack of supply. A few minutes ago, you mentioned how the Small Scale Meat Producers Association, a nonprofit representing small scale meat producers in the province, has worked really hard to create a couple of classes of slaughter licenses that are more flexible and accommodating of small scale for small scale producers, you know, with small herds to get slaughter done in a more efficient way that still maintains like adequate food safety. Can you talk a little bit about those opportunities that now exist? Like, can you tell us a little bit about these new licenses and how they work?
Yeah. So what they are is there's a FarmGate license and a FarmGate Plus license. And so essentially what that is it is a license once you're through the training and once you're through the protocols on it, that will allow you to take that animal from being harvested on farm, take it to a licensed cut and wrap facility, have it cut and wrapped, labeled accordingly to your FarmGate license or your FarmGate Plus license, and then allow it to be distributed, you know, either from the FarmGate or at farmers markets. And that's for the FarmGate license, not the FarmGate Plus. Mm-hmm. The FarmGate Plus license allows you to distribute it anywhere in the province of British Columbia, in any portion, whether that's direct to consumer, you know, you're selling to your neighbor down the road who wants to buy a quarter or a half or a whole beef or lamb or pork, or you can sell, you know, ground pork and cuts and whatever you want to restaurants anywhere in the province. And what that does is it's a schedule of labeling as well as a license that allows you to do that. And they have protocols that you have to follow in order for safe, you know, safe and humane animal handling, as well as dispatch, as well as cleanliness and making sure that everything is safe and is food grade. They've got an inspector who does, you know, an inspection for you, not at time of slaughter, but will do it prior to, you know, I believe it's once a year, or depending, it may be a case by case basis in order for you to do that. But that's huge as far as I'm concerned. That's huge. Number one, for animal welfare. I'll tell you that, for animal welfare, it is huge, because like I said, I've worked in plants and there's nothing knocking them, pardon the pun. But you know, I will say that when I go on farm and I process myself for my local guys, currently just for their own consumption, for their personal consumption, I see cattle and I see products that are coming out of there that are as high or higher quality than any products that are coming out of any licensed plant in British Columbia. Because, you know, the livestock are standing in a safe place where they don't feel any stress from transportation, any stress from being moved around whatsoever. And trust me, I've taken every, just whatever, you know, humane livestock handling course that I can take. you know, for working in the plants and to make sure that's the case, but not having to move that animal whatsoever, and it not having to have any type of adrenaline ran through its body and being processed on farm, to me, is the absolute best way that we can do it to provide the best product possible.
I guess what I want to ask you, first I want to talk about a producer. Like yourself, or if you don't count because of your special circumstances being a butcher, think of someone else in your region. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for them? Like I assume you're going to talk about, you know, you talked about your 250,000 kilometers you put on a vehicle back and forth, like, or you talked about 100 kilometers to the nearest plant. What does this mean? Yeah. Give an example of what this means for you as a rancher or a colleague.
When I look at those animals, the ones that are going to be done on farm, there's the cost savings of transportation to get to the abattoir. There's the time savings because I can go to work in the morning and I can custom cut somebody else's beef, or I can make sausages, or I can do 100 other things that I need to do in the time that I would be transporting beef to a plant, as well as going to pick up the carcasses and taking it back to my shop. For another producer, they're saving the time of hooking up to a trailer, taking an animal to a plant, dropping it off, and then coming back home. Again, I'm going to tout the horn of humane animal handling. And again, like I said, those cattle are raised in a pen. They never leave home. They have one bad day. They don't have to get pushed into a trailer and hauled down the road 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers, 50 kilometers, whatever that may be, unloaded in corrals that, you know, they've never been in, that smell like other animals, sat either overnight or for a couple hours in a water pen, moved up a chute into a knock box that rattles and clangs and that they don't know, and with different smells, sights, and sounds, you know, prior to being processed. When it's done humanely on farm, I will tell you 100%. You know, I did an animal last Wednesday for neighbors of ours. That's for them. We walked out there with a bucket of grain. We put a bucket of grain down. They came over to eat, and that animal had no clue. There was absolutely not a second of stress whatsoever for that animal prior to stun. And that, to me, that's the biggest thing that sold me on it and that I believe is the win. It's a win for us as producers. It's a win for processors. It's a win for local consumers 100%. It's a bigger win for the livestock, without a doubt. And because I can tell you that if I was one of them, that's exactly what I'd want.
Brody, what is farm land stewardship mean to you? Like to talk about stewardship as a farmer, that means different things to different farmers. Stewardship of your land, what does it mean to you?
The stewardship portion of it for me is that when we're taking something to make a living, we've got to give something back. And for me, that's habitat. And that's what we do. It's the ability to give good habitat, good carbon sequestering, have good healthy soils, good, healthy grassland, good, healthy stands of timbers, safe, clean water, you know, that isn't being polluted by animals, isn't being polluted by equipment and anything like that. It's having something that I'm going to be able to give to my kids and be proud that I'm giving my kids something of value. I judge everything we do off of wildlife, because if we don't have wildlife, because I've seen it growing up, you know, the wildlife we've had, if we don't have the wildlife, and they don't have the habitat, they don't want to be there, there's no way we're doing a good thing as far as a farmer. Because if the wildlife don't want to be there, the livestock don't want to be there, and there's something wrong. And they're my first telltale signs.
And so is there like, can you think, I'm just so curious, like as far as your stewardship goals, is there a practice that has been successful that you want to share?
You know, on my website, we've got a bit of a write-up, because we were always asked, and it was a running joke about local farmers. If you tell them that you have goats, they always say, why would you want a goat? But for us, in the ranch that we had leased, it had been very, very, very overrun with the weeds when we got there. And everybody said, this is the product you need to spray. You should spray this product and it'll work really well. And this is what you need to use. And you can do this. And if you till your fields this way and you work your fields this way, you can get rid of it this way and you can do that. And it wasn't something that we wanted to do. So we bought goats, and everybody said we're crazy. I mean, number one, don't get me wrong, my wife, her biggest dream was to have goats.
That helps.
And I thought she was crazy, but I could also see the benefit practices to having it. And I looked into it and I went, well, heck, let's give it a try. So we got one goat. And then we wound up getting up to the point where we were running 50 does and a couple of bucks, and we were raising kids. And not only were we getting rid of weeds and the weeds weren't coming back, the goats weren't eating my grass. They were eating our shrubs, which was creating more, and eating the brush, which was creating more grass for me. And they were eating the weeds, and they were giving me a byproduct of it. They're raising these kids, and these goats are getting fat. And I'm going, well, now they're worth something. And we could take them to market, and we could sell them. Or we had, you know, local people who wanted to purchase them. And we're making money off of these things that are also being used as a tool. I don't know about you, but, you know, Dad bought a brush mower 20 years ago. And I know what he spent on it. And I can guarantee you it's never made him a dime as far as giving him a byproduct. But the goats were doing it for us. And the pesticides weren't going to give me a good byproduct that the goats were giving me. And so to me, it just made logical sense. I could use something natural that was going to work to do a job that otherwise would have to be a chemical or a piece of machinery that wasn't natural. And I didn't think it was going to work as well. And we did. We brush hogged the pasture. And we grazed a pasture right next to it with goats, and we found out the exact same thing. We spent diesel fuel and compaction from tractors going over and over in time and labor when we kicked goats out on a pasture and we had weeds that did not come back.
And then
that was one of the best things that we ever did.
I'm so glad you mentioned the goats. It's so interesting. But I think I heard you say it's also turned out that the goats can have been a profitable enterprise in your business as far as the sales.
100%. We've moved away from how many we had originally only because our beef took off quite a bit more, and we've expanded our business into custom cutting, value added products, wild game cutting in the butcher shop, custom slaughtering. And we didn't quite have as much time. We also don't have as many weeds as we had. So we cut back quite a bit, but in the time that we were right into it, you know, for us, there was lots of times when, yeah, we were making, you know, we were making the grocery bill, or we were making whatever it was on goats. When I told you about the time that I lived, you know, when I made $19,000 a year and my rent was $18,000, the only reason I survived, goats. That was 100% what did it. I had a band of goats that we were doing custom grazing with. I had some custom grazing for a neighbor, get rid of some weeds, made a little money that way. I had some kids that I sold. I rehomed some. We butchered some at the abattoir. I hauled some to town to the market when the market was good. On a cultural market, you know, and yeah, 100% goats, you know, made it able for us to survive. So yeah, I can't really say enough for us. That was one of the best decisions we ever made, for sure.
Give me one or two breeds that you recommend. Doesn't matter the species. What are a couple breeds that have really worked for you?
I'm going to go left wing on you here. And when you say a couple of breeds,
sure,
I'm not going to give you a livestock that we raised for meat production, but a quarter horse. I couldn't do my job without horses. High quality horses to me are the number one thing. We don't do anything really with an ATV or a side-by-side. We don't own a side-by-side, but we own a lot of horses. And so for me, I love quarter horses, and I love them more than anything. They're the smartest animal in the world. As far as livestock to be raised, if we go into cattle, I have a hard time. I have a very hard time because I'm a crossbred kind of guy. And I love an F1 Baldy. I love a half Hereford, and I love a half Angus cow. And that's what I love. I love the hybrid vigor. I love the maternal instinct. I love the docility. I love the ease of fleshing. They've got good feet. And they always, always tend for me to have better fertility in my herd than cattle of a straight breed. And that's what I find. It seems like when I've got a cow that I think, boy, oh boy, when it comes time for preg check or we keep her, I think, man, I don't know if she's going to be open and she's going to be in the burger box or in the sausage box, or, you know, she's going to have a calf. She usually beats me, and she's always got one. We had a cow that made it to 23 years old. She was a half Hereford, half Angus cow. And that cow raised a calf from the time she was first bred. I think she died 23, and she had 21 calves for us. She lost a calf her second to last year. She lost a calf, no fault of her own. The calf died, and Dad said, that's it. She's done. It's her time. She went out, and we had a heifer that didn't want her calf. She stole the calf, and she raised it. Her final year, she was the front of the bunch going out to the range, and she didn't come home in the fall because she died. She died out there. So I can't sell them any better than that. Sheep, I'll tell you, it's a dorper. There isn't another breed, as far as I'm concerned, of sheep that gives you a better carcass or gives you more lambs on the ground. I mean, I had Dorper, we had Dorper ewes, you know, that we're getting, you know, three crops of lambs in 2 years on, right?
Yeah.
And ewes that are in good shape. And majority of the time, they're giving me a 200% lambing, a lambing rate on these Dorper ewes. And they were purebred Dorper ewes that we had that we originally bought. And, you know, they were the start of the best flock for us, for sure. That was Dorpers. And see, for me, when I selected it, yeah, everybody's got a breed they stand by, for sure. The nice thing that I was able to do, though, working in the slaughter plants, was I was able to see the carcasses coming off of lots of those breeds. And that's what sold me, especially when it comes to sheep. I will totem 1,000 times to one. The Dorper breed is where it's at.
All right, I gotta have a goat. I gotta have a goat before we move on.
A goat? And you're gonna laugh, and I know you're gonna laugh when I say this, because everybody's got, I'm gonna tell you, I'm a meat breed guy and I love boar goats and I think they're fantastic. But I don't think you can beat, when you cross a good boar goat, a good boar buck, onto maybe not quite as good of a dairy style nanny. We used to have some Nubian nannies that we got from a lady down there, a lady in Selma who milked them, and she raised them for years. And she sold them to us for meat. My wife fell in love with them, and I thought, what the heck are we doing? We were running straight boars pretty well and straight Spanish goats. We had Spanish and boar goats, and we had these Nubian nannies, and they got bred. We kicked them out. Those were the best dang kids we ever raised. I never had one that dressed as good as that or had as good of spread of rib and wide across the back. Like, spring of rib was fantastic. Like, I'm talking just about show goat looking, and if you didn't know who their mothers were, you'd be very surprised.
Brody, you're a lot of fun. You got 5 or 10 more minutes in you?
You betcha. Yeah, all right. Absolutely.
What could improve BC's farming sector, and who needs to take action?
Fair marketing for local BC meat products in stores and in places where people can buy it. Yes, I can stand on the hill and I can blow my horn and I can say, everyone come around and buy my product, why I can sell it. And this is why I should sell it to you, and this is why you should buy it. But a big thing that we could do is get local BC products into grocery stores and into the mainstream market. It should be, as far as I'm concerned, I understand that business is business and everybody has to make a dollar, but I truly believe that it should be number one in our province to sell our products. Yes, export is fantastic and that's important, but you can't tell me that you can ask one person in BC or that they would rather eat meat that comes from the United States or comes from South America compared to eating beef that was born or that was bred, born, raised, processed, and sold in the province of British Columbia by a British Columbian.
What do you foresee being the biggest challenge for your work over the next 5 years?
Well, that one is actually really, really simple. And that's labor, 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 and more labor. As well as skills training and competing with other industries for wages. That's for me where it's at.
So can you give us a little bit of context in your own operation, what that looks like? Well, where does it hurt?
For me, it's in the butcher shop, and it's finding skilled labor. And that's, you know, we're in a coal mining area and a logging area. Well, the coal mine, you know, essentially to start, you're at $40-some an hour, you're $90,000 a year. How do I take somebody off the street who I'm going to put 30% of the time that they're at work minimum into training them to do a job and to become someone who is skilled in a trade? And I'm going to start off by paying them a competitive wage to, say, the mill or, say, the mine. So the flip side of that is, okay, well, you don't get those employees. Well, when you don't get those employees, sometimes you get the employees who don't have the attention to detail and aren't willing to look at every single thing and go, somebody's last name is on every single package that goes out this door. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the hardest thing.
All right. Well, I'm going to end with a question that I know you're going to enjoy answering for sure. I want to bring you back to this, this rancher in Alberta you mentioned earlier, this mentor of yours. Just tell us his name again and tell us why he was such a great mentor to you. What did he teach you?
So mentors in agriculture, I've got two. I've got my dad and I've got David Ball. He 100% instilled the passion of agriculture in me. He owns UXL Ranching with his family in southern Alberta. He's just south of Calgary. One of the number one things he taught me that really has always stuck with me, and I think about it on a daily basis, is that a dollar saved is a dollar made. And he tells a story about how when him and his wife first got married and they're building the ranch, he wasn't making a lot of money. And steel gates at that time were worth about $100. Steel gate was worth $100. And he needed a bunch of steel gates. And he went, I just can't afford it. And so he started building wood gates at night after work. And for every wood gate he built, he hung up on the fence. And he said, well, there's $100 I can spend somewhere else. And that story from a man who is, one who is, I will say, the most successful cattle rancher and cattleman and businessman that I know. If you met him on the street, you wouldn't know it because he's the nicest man in the world. But he also taught me that a dollar saved is a dollar made. The other thing he taught me is you do it because it's right, even when it's hard. You do it because it's right for the cattle. You do it because it's right for the animal and it's the right thing to do. Whether or not you don't look at it. One time I remember working for him and we had a little bit of a bad bout that year with some scours and calves, and we had some calves dying. And I remember a day we had a couple calves die and we had a cow die, and he had a neighbor stop by, and a neighbor, I'd come to him at the end of the day, and I talked to the neighbor just before he went up to the house to talk to David, and I said, son of a gun, you know, I said, we lost four calves today, and we lost a cow. And the neighbor said, yeah, look at that, $2,500 there, and each one of those replacement calves is $500 a piece, you know, and that's $2,000. You lost $4,500 today. I said to David, I said, yeah, we've been treating this cow for pneumonia. I said, we lost her. I said, and we lost them other four calves that were in the sick room, David. I said, I'm really, really sorry that we lost them. And David said to me, I said, but you know what really made me mad? Is I said, he said that it was the dollar value. And David said, that's the difference. He said, when you love agriculture and you love what you do, you don't see the dollar value. You do it because it's the right thing to do. You don't do it because it's not profitable. You don't just say, nah, that's not profitable, we're not going to do it. If it's the right thing to do for the animal, you do that. And the only other thing he taught me was about family that really stuck with me. And I remember saying to him, my wife and I got pregnant with our little boy and our business wasn't started and I wasn't making a lot of money. And I was really worried. We didn't work for them at the time, but we still talk quite frequently and they're a big part of our lives. And I said to him, and I remember being kind of nervous about it. And he said to me, you know what, Brody? He said, people say that kids aren't profitable. He said, I made $1 million per kid that I ever had, and I expanded my operations because of them. He said, you know why? He said, because when you have them and you love them and you're in charge of them, you got to work. You'll work that hard just to make something for them. And he was 100% right. And every time for me, when it gets tough and I think agriculture, I think of David Ball. And I think of the fact that when I do things in my business and sometimes I get frustrated and you're running short of time and there's a shortcut to think, I can hear him in my head and the way that he says it, that you do it because it's right, not because it's easy. You just do the right thing. And I try really hard to strive for that.
I think that's a great place to leave it, Brody. Thanks so much for getting on the phone with me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
I've really enjoyed it as well, Jordan.
All right. That's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. Please check back here soon for more long-form conversations with people from BC's ag sector. If you have suggestions for future guests of the show, I'm all ears. podcast@farminginbc.ca. Finally, if you're a farmer in British Columbia, remember, we have a lot more in common than all our differences would suggest. All right, I'm Jordan Marr, and I'll talk to you next time.